Good afternoon. We have one matter for argument remaining on our calendar this morning. State of Minnesota versus Christopher Paul Mattson. Each attorney will have 15 minutes for argument. The appellant will have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We would ask each attorney to identify themselves before they begin their presentation, and the appellant may begin when ready.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Abigail Rankin, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Christopher Paul Mattson, in this matter. This case involves a police-led investigation under the guise of a pretrial conditions check and the state's failure to prove Mr. Mattson knowingly possessed someone else's trash. I'd like to focus on two issues today. First, the district court's reliance on evidence that was outside the record in the omnibus hearing, and second, the insufficiency of the evidence. Ultimately, I ask you to reverse Mr. Mattson's conviction under either theory. The district court here relied on evidence that was not introduced during the omnibus hearing for this matter. On the day that this matter had the omnibus hearing, there were three files on for omnibus. They were dealt with consecutively, and at the beginning of the hearing for all three of them, the court asked counsel how they desired to proceed. Counsel indicated that they should create a record in each file individually, and counsel then proceeded to do so. There was no overlap in the transcripts between each hearing, as far as I'm aware. The transcript we have for this matter only indicates what happened in the file on appeal here today.
Can I stop you, Ms. Rankin? When you say there was no overlap, I'm not sure exactly what you mean, but I'm imagining, based on what you said so far, that the witnesses would have repeated themselves perhaps once or twice in order, you know, they, in three different hearings might have said the same thing three different times. Is that, am I correct in surmising that?
I think you would be. We don't know because we don't have the other transcripts, but what I meant by that was that there's no reference to prior testimony made by any of the witnesses. There's no, as you said earlier, or as Officer so-and-so said earlier, anything like that.
There's no express incorporation of the fact findings in each of the separate proceedings.
Precisely. The only evidence that the district court had in this omnibus on which to base a finding of reasonable suspicion was one instance of a woman visiting Mr. Mattson's home for a short period of time the day before the search was executed, and one report from an off-duty deputy witnessing what I refer to in my brief as mailbox behavior. Mr. Mattson reached into a mailbox that did not belong to him, took something unidentified, and then left. There's no further indication of either of these instances that something was related to drugs about these behaviors. There's no indication that Mr. Mattson was acting squirrely after he took something out of the mailbox, or that the item he took out of the mailbox resembled a large amount of cash consistent with drug sale or a package of drugs. There's no indication that the off-duty deputy confronted Mr. Mattson after the mailbox behavior and he seemed squirrely. None of that's here in the record. It's just taking something from a mailbox. The other instance of behavior, that short-term traffic, I think traffic is somewhat of a misnomer here. There's one person who goes to Mr. Mattson's house for a brief period of time. There's an indication that she's knocking on the windows and doors, but that's simply because Mr. Mattson was not at home. The woman who reported the tip noted that Mr. Mattson arrived home while this woman was knocking on the door, interacted with her, and then she left a short time later. Nothing about these allegations indicates that she left, again, with a bundle of cash, with an item identifiable as drugs, that she was later arrested with any kind of controlled substance. These are the only two facts in the record here on which the court could have properly based its finding of reasonable suspicion, and they're insufficient. These two facts support perhaps a hunch of criminal activity, but no more. And reasonable articulable suspicion certainly requires more than a hunch of criminal activity.
And the district court, on the last page of its order, said basically relied on all of the circumstances in this case. Well, excuse me. Well, I think that's a fair way to describe the district court's reasoning, is that the district court was relying on all of the circumstances, and so that, I think you would agree that that includes both facts, circumstances that are in the record and circumstances not in the record. Correct so far? I mean, do you agree with me so far?
I would agree that the court relied on facts outside of the record, yes.
As well as facts inside the record without differentiating, it seems. But so what, if that's so, what would be the proper remedy for us? How do we analyze that? Do we say that's error and we reverse outright, saying that the denial of the motion to suppress is in error without any further reconsideration? Do we reverse and remand for the district court to reconsider based only on the evidence in the record, or do we look at the record ourselves and look at the first two facts and circumstances that you've identified and make our own determination about whether it meets the standard?
I think the second suggestion that you made, that you look at the evidence that the court relied on, these two factors, and determine whether that meets the standard. Here, I think it's fair to say that the evidence in the record, these two points, do not support reasonable articulable suspicion, and it's safe to overturn that order and find that the facts in the record do not support that order. So I think you can reverse outright. I'd also like to just note that in the record, there is no testimony that officers were particularly considering this an investigation of a specific pretrial condition violation. In fact, most of the evidence in the record suggests that this was a pretextual crime investigation. There is, in fact, a quote outright from one of the officers who said, "We're investigating meth. That's why they behaved a certain way during this stop. They're investigating meth." And prior to initiating this search, multiple officers conversed about things that Mr. Mattson might be involved in. Another officer said, "I think he's involved in a check type case." They don't specify how, they just say he's involved in it and he wants to talk to him about that. So this stop is very clearly approaching the house to talk with Mr. Mattson about these independent matters unrelated to his pretrial conditions. With that, I will pivot to the sufficiency argument. The state's evidence here did not exclude beyond a reasonable doubt any reasonable inference other than guilt. There is a reasonable inference other than guilt here that Ms. Kimberly Blank is the woman who owned the items that Mr. Mattson was charged with. The state relied at trial on a theory of constructive possession that the item was in a place under exclusive control to which others do not normally have access. And Mr. Mattson's garage is not a place of exclusive control to which others did not have access. Ms. Blank's belongings in the trash in his garage indicate that others had access to this garage. And they weren't simply items that might have been found on the street or items that might have normally been left behind in a plastic bag. There was some mail with Ms. Blank's name on it, in addition to an EBT receipt that traced back to her and a receipt with her name on it as well. These items were found close to the contraband that Mr. Mattson was charged with and indicate that Ms. Blank could reasonably have possessed those items. This court does not give any deference to the jury's choice between competing but reasonable inferences. And here it's uncontroverted that Ms. Blank's items were in Mr. Mattson's home, very close to the items with which he was charged. The jury rejected the inference that it was hers, but this court does not defer to that. Because the sufficiency standard, the evidence must exclude beyond a reasonable doubt any reasonable inference other than guilt, the state has failed to make that proof here. It's reasonable to conclude on these facts that Ms. Blank disposed of her refuse in Mr. Mattson's garbage heap, and that Mr. Mattson never knowingly possessed the straw with trace substance. Exhibit number 3 from the trial exhibits depicts the garage, which shows the extent of this trash heap. It's a rather large repository, if you will, of garbage. Exhibit 4 then shows a box in which the substances and the receipts and the mail were found. And Exhibit 5 is a close-up of those items. Exhibit 5 and 4, comparing the two, seems to suggest that there was a lot of digging involved to find these items within that box. They weren't neatly placed on top. They weren't warm, indicating recent use. They were buried in this trash as if they had been disposed of by Ms. Blank sometime prior to this search. The trial transcript also notes one of the officers on page 59 says that Mr. Mattson had mentioned Ms. Blank and said that she was a friend of a friend. And we know that there had been activity around the house the day before, so it's not unreasonable to conclude that Ms. Blank had been there before and had left those items behind. The insufficiency argument here itself requires reversal of Mr. Mattson's conviction outright, no remand. The reasonable articulable suspicion argument here, the court's error does require reversal as well, and I think there can be two possible paths for that, as articulated in my brief. The judge relied on evidence outside the record, which could be considered either a violation of judicial impartiality, or it could be considered as problematic for relieving the state of its burden to prove at the omnibus that they had that reasonable articulable suspicion at the time of the search.
So the reasonable suspicion standard is fairly low. Why is it not satisfied here, even with just the information about the neighbor's call and the mailbox behavior?
Because the reasonable articulable suspicion standard still requires specific articulable facts that, taken together with rational inferences from those facts, reasonably warrant this search. And reasonable inferences from these facts do not support the search here of Mr. Mattson's home, which is very central to his Fourth Amendment rights here. The facts don't indicate anything that suggests that these are drug behavior. The district court's order relies on a couple different cases when referring to this as short-term traffic. And both of those cases involve, I believe, one required heavy traffic and one referred to repeated instances. So that's much more than this one person coming to Mr. Mattson's home. And those things are potentially indicative of drug trafficking, but one visit from one friend is not. And the mailbox itself, there's no evidence in the record that the mailbox belonged to someone who was involved in the drug trade or anything like that. The closest we get is testimony that the mailbox was in a location frequented by people with records of drug offenses. That's nowhere near as direct as we would need to support an inference that, therefore, reaching into this mailbox was drug activity, drug trade activity, as alleged by the state.
What were the charges in the two prior cases, and were they drug-related?
They were. They were both fifth-degree controlled substance charges, but those were not mentioned at all on the record at the omnibus as supporting the basis for the search.
But, I mean, somewhere in the omnibus record, there must be a reference to the terms of his pretrial release?
There is, yes. And the pretrial release orders don't contain any information about the nature of the charges for which he is on pretrial release.
Okay. But I guess officers were aware. I mean, the record allows the district court to infer that officers were aware that he had pending charges. One or
yes.
more pending charge.
Yes. But nothing more specific than that. As I noted, in the omnibus testimony, the officers not once referred to the pending charges as one of their reasons for concern that Mr. Mattson might potentially be violating his conditions of release. They didn't discuss the nature of those charges. They only referred to them insofar as they used the conditions of release as a reason to get into Mr. Mattson's home to conduct this investigatory search. If there are no further questions, I would ask that this court reverse Mr. Mattson's convictions under either theory, each independently is sufficient to reverse Mr. Madsen's conviction. Taken together, they certainly are as much.
Thank you, Ms. Rankin. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Scott Bueller. I am the Senior Assistant Polk County Attorney. I'm appearing here in Crookston today. I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this appeal. Counsel has essentially limited her argument today to two issues. She did raise a third in her brief, something I want to touch upon at the end of my argument. But I would like to start where counsel ended with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence in this case. One of the problems with counsel's entire argument is that it's based upon nothing but speculation. Counsel wants to argue that because there were documents with Kimberly Blank's name found on them in the garage near the methamphetamine and the paraphernalia, that you should infer from that somehow this methamphetamine and the paraphernalia belonged to her. You could make the opposite speculation, that is that Mr. Madsen stole those documents, that Ms. Blank gave them to her on another occasion, that he found them. But again, that's speculation. You're supposed to decide this case based upon the evidence, not speculation.
Well, the question isn't
the other isn't red the, herrings here is this argument
Mr.
that
Bueller.
Ms. Blank somehow
Mr. Bueller, can you hear me?
Exactly what counsel said in her argument. Ownership isn't the issue. It's possession. That is, did the defendant possess those items?
Mr. Bueller, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Okay. I can now.
Okay.
I had a question about what you said a minute ago. I mean, isn't our, under the case law concerning circumstantial evidence, isn't it necessary for us to ask the question whether the circumstantial evidence supports any other rational inference, including a rational inference that would be consistent with innocence or not guilty, such as, and so, I mean, we're not choosing that whether one is more proper than the other, but simply whether the circumstantial evidence here supports the inference that she possessed the drugs and whether that's a rational inference. Isn't that the question?
That's correct. That is the way the standard is framed, but I would note that in framing that, also the Minnesota Supreme Court reiterated in Harris that the evidence is supposed to be viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict, and it's after this court winnows down the evidence presented at trial by resolving all questions of fact in favor of the jury's verdict. The only fact in this record is that Ms. Blank's documents were found in proximity to the methamphetamine paraphernalia. That's it. There is no fact in this record about how those items got there. Like I said, counsel is speculating from the fact that those documents are present that somehow the methamphetamine and the paraphernalia belong to Ms. Blank. Well, you could speculate to the opposite, like I indicated. There are other rationales that you could come up with, but they would all be based on speculation. Instead, you have to decide the case based upon the evidence as presented at trial.
The
circumstances proved are the defendant was living at this residence by himself.
Does the proximity
no one else
between
was
the
present at the time the search took place?
Can you hear me?
No one else living or staying with him at that
Mr.
time?
Mr. Bueller?
Yes.
We're having trouble communicating with you because we're asking questions and you're talking over us. So we don't know if you can hear us.
And I have to admit, Your Honor, I could not hear anything prior to your just saying that.
Okay. And can you hear me now? Can you hear Judge Ross?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Are you suggesting that it's not reasonable, that a reasonable inference cannot be drawn between with regard to the proximity of the drugs and the documents to conclude that someone other than the defendant possessed the drugs? You're saying that's not a reasonable inference?
I say it's an inference, but it is not reasonable given these facts when you look at the rest of the facts that are the fact that the defendant also tested positive for methamphetamine on that date, which is something you normally don't have in most of these cases. And when you compare these facts to State versus Cusick, the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in 1986, I think that's the case that is the strongest on the facts for me, in that case, you have a defendant who was driving a motor vehicle, belonged to another person, was involved in an accident. The law enforcement officers find a cocaine user's kit. He's charged with possessing it. The actual owner of the motor vehicle comes in and testifies at trial that it was her motor vehicle. The cocaine user's kit had been in her purse at the back of the vehicle. The defendant wasn't aware of it. She, at that time, was addicted to speed and cocaine, and she provided a complete exoneration to him. And in that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court found that the evidence was sufficient to affirm the defendant's conviction, pointing out that the defendant appeared to be under the influence of something, although they didn't get a urine sample from him at that time. And even though the expert testimony indicated that cocaine would normally make someone excitable or nervous, not lethargic like the defendant was in that case. In that case, you actually have evidence, concrete evidence attempting to exonerate the defendant, in which the jury was able to weigh and conclude otherwise, and the Supreme Court deferred to that. In this case, again, all you have is those documents. If Ms. Blank was residing in the residence at the time, if there was a witness who could put her in that garage, in the residence, or somewhere in proximity at some point in time, I would agree that that is a legitimate inference to be drawn from the record. But there is none of that evidence in this record. And I think the district court hit the nail on the head when denying the defendant's motion for a judgment of acquittal, in that this is a possible inference. It doesn't make it a rational or reasonable inference when you consider the totality of the circumstances, which this court is supposed to do under Harris and the circumstantial evidence standard, particularly with the defendant's positive urine test result. And then going to the reasonable suspicion argument, I will acknowledge that the district court's order in this case is somewhat convoluted, and that because I think the district court was trying to parcel out omnibus hearings conducted in three different cases involving the same defendant on the same date, that she does have some overlapping facts. With regard to the district court's order,
when you say the district court's order was convoluted, are you acknowledging that the district court improperly considered evidence that was not presented in this particular case at the omnibus hearing?
I would agree with that. But I don't believe that that's essential to the district court's ruling ultimately in this case. You know, it's like a harmless error analysis that you would normally do at trial. Just because a piece of evidence is wrongly admitted and considered by a jury doesn't mean the defendant's automatically entitled to reversal of his conviction. You determine whether or not the district court, the reliance upon that evidence would have swayed their opinion. I do personally think that if you're going to conclude that the district court's reliance was improper, remand is the proper way to do this, for the district court to rely upon or to make clear exactly what it is she was relying upon in rendering her decision. But I do think counsel misstates the argument when she, you know, she says there are only two factors present in this case, and that is the neighbor's call and this rather strange incident with the defendant at somebody's mailbox. She leaves out the fact that the defendant was actually on conditions of release in two separate cases, both involving possession of methamphetamine.
Well, do we know that? Did the district judge know that he was on pretrial release for a charge of meth?
Yes, she did.
Is the record clear of that in the context of this case as opposed to the other omnibus proceedings?
Well, the only thing that's truly clear in this case is that, in fact, the conditional release orders from the two prior cases were put into evidence, and Investigator Nelson from the Crookston Police Department said that prior to going to Mr. Mattson's house, he actually knew that he was out on conditions of release in those two cases, and as it turns out, he actually was the officer involved in both of those investigations. So, again, the record just as it exists in this case is not very clear, because Investigator Nelson had also testified in the previous two omnibus hearings that had just immediately preceded this one. So I think that's where part of the problem comes from, is that these officers are testifying over and over and over again, and not everything finally got into the ultimate record. But what is in the record is that the defendant was out on conditions of release in two separate cases, that Investigator Nelson was aware of that, in fact, the second case was a violation of conditions of release in the first case, is what the district court made clear in her order. So it isn't like this is being taken in a vacuum here. You have to put it in the context of a person who is out on conditions of release in two separate felony cases, that the strange behavior is being brought to the attention of law enforcement. But the one thing that also has gotten
Counsel, let me interrupt for a minute. I agree that it's distinctive that there's conditional release on two prior charges. But you combine that with what you refer to as strange behavior, which is the neighbor's call regarding that person and the mailbox behavior. That is still very thin. That's strange behavior, but how is that reasonable articulable suspicion?
Well, And I think that's the next point I was leading to, Your Honor, is what I also think is in the record here, is the defendant's erratic behavior, his mood swings, his up and down, the evidence that indicates that he appears to be under the influence before the officers ever conduct a search. Granted, they didn't know that at the time that they approached his residence, but they didn't need any reason to simply go to his residence and knock on the door. But when the defendant then is engaging in this very, very bizarre behavior, which both officers testified to at trial, indicated to them in their experience that he was under the influence of methamphetamine, that, I believe, adds to what the district court had previously found. Now, again, the district court doesn't conclude that, but that's evidence that's in the record. This very strange behavior that he had. It's that totality of the circumstances, and I agree with the district court that you can't point to any one specific factor and say that in and of itself would have been sufficient to find reasonable suspicion on these facts. But it is a low standard, and it's supposed to be based upon the totality of the circumstances, and that totality of circumstances includes this very strange behavior by the defendant when they first approach his residence. And I just would like to just address one final issue, and that is the one that appellant spends the bulk of her brief arguing, and that is that this court should find the district court erred by not finding that probable cause was required for this search. One real problem that I have with this type of argument is that this issue was never presented to the district court in any way, shape, or form. The words probable cause aren't mentioned in the motion to suppress. They're not mentioned in the omnibus hearing. They're not mentioned in the letter brief filed by appellant's counsel. There is no objection to the district court's order. I mean, that's another issue here, is that there wasn't any objection to the district court's order when it was issued with regard to her considering this other evidence. But now you're being asked to find the district court was wrong when it was never given a chance to be right on this issue as to whether or not a conditional release search can only be based upon probable cause. And I also think it's misleading in the way that counsel attempts to frame that issue, in that Minnesota is unique, in that, at least unique compared to most states, in that defendants are required to be given two options for bail, unconditional or conditional. That is, a defendant has an option to avoid being subject to searches and testing if that is imposed as conditional release by choosing an unconditional option, posting cash bail. So when counsel phrases the issue in the context of saying that only probable cause can justify this search, I think that's very misleading, because the Fourth Amendment's touchstone is reasonableness, not probable cause. And you have to consider in that reasonableness calculus the fact that the defendant's out on conditions of release in two cases, pursuant to a court order that he specifically was made aware of, with an option that he chose. And in this record, there's absolutely nothing to indicate that he did not specifically agree to that, those conditions. As the Minnesota Supreme Court said in State versus Anderson in 2007, you in fact have to presume that these orders were validly issued given the state of the record. And counsel wants to ignore all that. But I go back to, I believe that this first issue that counsel spends most of her appellate brief arguing simply isn't properly before this court, because the issue was waived pursuant to Rule 1001 Subdivision 2. And the interest of justice exception to appellate review don't somehow override that explicit waiver provision. I just want to make it clear, because I find it very difficult to write an appellate brief trying to argue about what a district court might or might not done depending upon an argument that was presented to it when it's not in the record any way, shape, or form. And I think it's extremely unfair to the district court to find fault with her for not considering an issue that wasn't raised to her in any way, shape, or form.
With
but ultimately,
respect
I'm
to
asking this court to affirm the defendant's conviction. I believe the evidence is sufficient.
Excuse me. With respect to the argument about findings and analysis based on facts not in the record, I'm unclear whether you are asking us to look at the record and affirm, or whether you're suggesting that we should remand to the district court for further consideration. Or are you? Which are you urging us to do?
Well, I will, just to be candid, Your Honor, I believe both options are available to you. I believe you have the ability to look at the record yourself as it exists and make that independent determination. But generally, what this court has done is not made its own fact findings. Instead, you've looked to the district court's factual findings, and if they're not clear in a case like this, you would normally remand to the district court to make clear that she could only decide this case based upon the facts presented at the omnibus hearing. So I believe either option is available to this court, although I believe the ultimately the remand option is the one that's fair to the district court because it allows the district court to actually make those findings based upon the record, and then that presents a better record for this court to review when it comes back up on appeal. Otherwise, you're being placed in the position of having to make factual findings in place of the district court.
If we were to remand for the error in what evidence ought to be considered, should the district court also be given the opportunity to address the standard of the burden of proof?
I believe that issue has been waived under Rule 1001 Subdivision 2, Your Honor. I don't believe that you could reopen that issue on remand. Because that issue has been affirmatively waived because it wasn't raised below.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bueller.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Rankin, any rebuttal?
Yes, please. So I have a few points. I'll just take them in order of my notes here. First, this is not speculation. Looking at the reasonable inference does not constitute speculation here. We're looking at reasonable inferences, as Judge Johnson noted. We're allowed to do that. In fact, we must do that to determine if this conviction is adequate. In Cusick, the cocaine was found in a car with the defendant who later tested positive, or who later exhibited signs of being under the influence. In this case, the methamphetamine is not found anywhere near Mr. Mattson. It's not found in his pocket. It's not found shoved in the couch next to him. It's not found within his wingspan. It's found buried in a trash heap in his garage with someone else's belongings. The second case that Mr. Mattson was on conditional release for regarded a violation of conditions of release in the first case, which was noted in the order. But again, that's not in the record for this omnibus at all. There's no discussion of those cases in this omnibus record or the nature of the charges.
I mean, can't we assume that the district court was aware? I mean, having presided over hearings in these three related cases, she surely knew that. And I mean, aren't we permitted to give her the benefit of that knowledge?
The state has to prove that the evidence was supportive of reasonable articulable suspicion, and the state did not offer evidence that Mr. Mattson was on conditional release for those things, which would tend to support reasonable suspicion. So I don't believe we can consider that evidence if it's not in the record. Counsel for the state also notes that the officers observed erratic behavior from Mr. Mattson, but the district court doesn't use this as a basis for its findings. The officers didn't argue that this is why they were conducting the search. And Mr. Mattson's anger is understandable here. Officers approached his home. Testimony indicates one with a gun tucked behind his leg. Later, a gun was pointed directly at Mr. Mattson. Mr. Mattson repeatedly asked for access to counsel, and his requests were not acknowledged. I think his behavior is understandable and does not, given that it wasn't relied upon, it certainly doesn't support an alternative ground here. The court's findings were very clear. The district court knew that it was confined to the evidence that was in the record, and allowing an additional crack at that, another bite at the apple, as it were, is not appropriate in this case. I'll briefly turn to the harmless error component of that counsel argues regarding the evidence, consideration of the evidence outside the record. The harm here is readily observable, readily identifiable. The district court's order denied Mr. Mattson's motion suppressing the sole evidence on the basis that formed the basis for his charge. And the order relied on, I think I outlined it as six factors, only two of which were actually in the record here, one of which the district court expressly states is insufficient on its own to support reasonable articulable suspicion, the other of which is the mailbox behavior, which itself, again, is not sufficient here either. The error is clear, or the harm is clear, and the error has been conceded by the counsel. I'll briefly note regarding the probable cause argument, the motion before the district court did refer to a warrantless search and challenging the warrantless search. So the issue was before the court's consciousness, as it were. And counsel argues that there's nothing to indicate that the defendant didn't agree, that Mr. Mattson didn't agree to these terms, but it's a term of conditional release. They're not negotiated between the court and the defendant. They're set by the court unilaterally, and the defendant has to abide by them or stay in custody. So I think that argument is kind of a bit of a red herring there. If there are no further questions, I would again ask that you reverse Mr. Mattson's convictions.
Nothing further, Ms. Rankin. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both. Matter will be taken under advisement, and an opinion will issue in 90 days.